music of Béla Bartók, and we note the Hungarian composer's birth this past Friday. It's also a day to celebrate one of his iconic operas, thanks to the COC. And that's where we're heading next. You're with the Oasis here on the New Classical FM, bottom of the clock. My name is Mark Wigmore. Our look at the arts is next. Adam Egoyan is here. For nearly 40 years, the Armenian-Canadian's films have offered up engaging, award-winning stories that have been celebrated around the world. From his breakthrough Exotica to his multiple Oscar nominations for The Sweet Hereafter, later the thriller Chloe, and Remember, one of the final films for Canadian actor Christopher Plummer. He's won awards at the Cannes Film Festival, in Venice, TIFF, at the Canadian Screen Awards. In 2015, he received the Governor General's Performing Arts Award. His stories engage in ways that challenge, exploring isolation, power structures, the hidden backstories of characters, and playing with linear time. Over the weekend, the Canadian Opera Company debuted a digital performance of Bartók's Bluebeard's Castle. Egoyan is the director. It is his fourth directorial project with the COC. In this interpretation, he melds his award-winning film Felicia's Journey with Bartók's one-act opera. As a comparison, in Egoyan's 1999 film, Bob Hoskins, the actor, is a serial killer who preys on women in Birmingham, England. In Bartók's 1918 opera, we witness the grisly fairy tale of Bluebeard, whose new bride, Judith, begins to suspect that the doors of her husband's castle conceal gruesome secrets. This new production is built for our times. It is screening as part of the COC's A Season Like No Other digital series at coc.ca. It is my pleasure to welcome, finally, Adam Egoyan to the New Classical FM studios.
Hi.
Great to be with you. I feel like I've been on your periphery for a very long time. Your wife, Arsene, has been in here several times. Your sister Eve was on the program last year, and to talk about that great documentary about her. Robert Lantos, your longtime producer, was on the podcast, and I think when he was here, he had just been out for an evening of wine drinking with you and some other filmmakers that day. I'm just a huge fan of your body of work, so thank you so much for being here.
Well, that was a great intro. It actually made me realize why I was so drawn to doing this project. It was a very unusual offering.
And nice to be with a fellow Victoria guy. I grew up in Victoria.
Oh, did you?
You grew up in Victoria. I think about growing up in Cordova Bay, and you went to Mount Doug.
Yeah, and I grew up on Cabro Bay.
Right? So I went down there all the time with all the octopus and all those like different creatures on the beach.
So are you from Victoria?
I'm from Victoria, yeah.
Oh, I'm going there in a week. I'm going back.
Yeah, that's right. You're doing the 25th anniversary of Sweet Hereafter.
Yeah, I'm doing that in Vancouver.
Okay.
And then going over to Victoria. But where I grew up too.
It's funny to think of that as a city that could, you know, be an incubator for a talent of your caliber, because I think of Victoria and I loved it and it was a nice place to grow up, but, you know, it's by no means an arts hub or anything like that.
Well, my parents were both painters, and there are a lot of visual artists there that were very important, and I was aware of that scene. The conservatory music is really important there.
Absolutely.
And
sure.
My sister got her start there, and I studied classical guitar. One of the reasons I came to Toronto was to study guitar with Ellie Kasner, and, you know, who was the foremost classical guitar teacher in the country at the time.
I don't know about you, but I always felt like, okay, at some point I have to get to a big city. I have to take this to the next level.
For sure. And at the time, Vancouver wasn't big enough, or wasn't far away enough, I should say. Toronto was the obvious place. I go back, and I do think that there is a strong cultural feeling in the city, and I think it punches above its weight, certainly. I went to the same high school that David Foster went to.
Right.
And Nelly Furtado went to.
He's been here, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, that's just one high school, Mount Doug. You know?
It's true.
It's a cinder block building. You wouldn't think twice about it, but somehow there's something going on.
And you touched on music. I mean, it does have a pretty strong music scene there, and I think it's only blossomed further in the last, you know, how many years since you and I have been there, but... I'm really excited about what you've created for the COC, but I want to start macro and get your thoughts on the state of cinema here in 2022. Certainly your friend Robert Lantos gave me an earful when he was here last time talking about cinema. But I mean, just a few examples. Denis Villeneuve, he had to fight to get Dune on the big screen. It was a very public fight a couple of years back. Scorsese feeling that backlash over what he's had to say about superhero films and so on. The huge surge of streaming services during the pandemic, more or less making our small screens the screen. it's pretty wild out there right now. And I think as a filmmaker, you've been doing this for a long time. Where are we? What's your take on this moment?
I'm just finding it really difficult to understand how much I can expect of my audience to commit themselves. When there were cinemas and when people went to the cinema, they were committed to that space for an hour and a half.
Right.
And that definitely allowed you to tell a story in a certain way. And you still have that when you go to live theater and when you see an opera. You're committed. Over the last 2 years, we're not so sure how committed we really are.
Right.
That sense of urgency, that sense of the event, that sense of the festival, like what the film festival used to mean.
Sure.
As a way to launch these auteur-driven films, you know, these independent films. That's shifted.
I saw Nightmare Alley the other day, and I watched it on television. And I really enjoyed the film, but I did think about halfway through as I was checking my phone and grabbing a glass of water, I was almost mad that I had that opportunity. I said, I wish I was just totally immersed in this. Less and less that is the case, specifically for those types of films, too.
I find myself mad at myself very often.
Right.
That I allow myself to be distracted, that I allow myself to be checking something out. And I'm quite rigorous about that. But it may well be that someone like me needs to be in a cinema or needs to be in a live theater, needs to respect the rules whereby I'm paying attention with a lot of other people. And we've made that commitment.
Right.
But that seems to be more and more rarefied.
Are we now making art for distracted people? I mean,
whoa,
is that the idea?
It's a scary thought, but I think it's quite possible. I mean, look, artists make art any way they can, but you need to be able to find an audience. And when that audience has such a wealth of opportunity and, you know, feels that they need to catch up on what everyone else is seeing, you know, when we're driven by algorithms, right? When we're, our curiosity is actually directed by an algorithm, you know, if you watch this, you may like this. And very often what the algorithm detects you may like, you would actually like.
Right.
But, you know, you have to always remind yourself how you found yourself there. It was by something that was sensing what it was that was most popular for your type of sensibility.
Right.
And that's not necessarily how we grow as a viewer. Sometimes we find ourselves in places we don't expect to be at all. And suddenly doors open and we get really excited. So that way in which we discover, the way in which things are curated and presented to us, that's shifted profoundly.
Yeah,
we're all trying to understand how to recalibrate. And as artists, you know, I used to think that if a film got into a festival or if it had this distributor in that country, it would find the right audience. But that has been quite decimated. Now it's about a streaming service. So it's just thrown out there. And if it sticks, then it might have a chance. And if it doesn't, it disappears really quickly.
That ecosystem has totally changed.
It has.
Yeah.
And that's just a reality. So, you know, we're trying to figure it out. And it's still, we're really just after this major cataclysmic event that's really redefined what the performing arts mean to most people.
And changed our brains, I think, too, as well. Mm-hmm. Robert Lepage was here last week. He directed the stage version of Bluebeard's Castle.
Wonderful production.
And we had a great discussion about film versus theater, and he's been involved in both, perhaps maybe slightly the inverse of how you've worked your career, but he likes those last-minute changes you can make on the stage compared to film, that there's room to travel down unexpected avenues, and while you're engaged in the creative process, you can make these different decisions that maybe, you know, with film, it's a bit more rigid, you've got the script and so on. You've had personal experience creating both, and so what's your preference? Because I do think it is quite personal to your own sensibilities.
Yeah, and it's also very much dependent on the budget, right? The lower the budget of a film, the more control you have over it, and the more you can make those changes and those accommodations and explore.
Yeah.
You know, so some of the films of my own that I am closest to are films that I made without that huge commercial pressure, you know, where you're controlling a budget and there are millions of dollars at stake and there's a script that everyone has signed off on, which is a blueprint. This is how it has to actually unfold.
Right.
But in some of the films that I feel are most personal, that has changed. Like the structure of the film changes, the placement of scenes, the way the music works, sound design. I'm sculpting that right to the last moment. I have the freedom to do that.
Has your creativity sometimes been a victim of your own success in some ways? I mean, I know I've seen certainly really big films from you where you have all these incredible actors and so on. Yeah. And I wonder, wow, that seems like a different stage than, the earlier films.
Oh, right? it really is. And then you have to deal with test audiences. And you have to, like a film like Chloe, for instance, which with Julianne Moore and Liam Neeson and Amanda Seyfried, I never liked the ending of it as it was in the script. And so I said to the producers, like, you know, can we try this other ending, which isn't going to cost anything more?
Right.
We don't have to add
the
any
key
shooting
element
schedule, right? You know, and, you know, you test it, but then you realize that, oh, an audience maybe doesn't actually respond the way I'm feeling it. And then you're thankful that when you make a movie like Sweet Hereafter or Exotica, you don't have to test it. You can just do it and take it to a festival and see how people react to the finished work, as opposed to asking people how they feel about something in progress.
Right.
Look, we know that people don't necessarily like the feeling of not getting something or feeling mystified. And if you ask them for clarity, they will want that clarity.
Right, right.
But if you say that this is actually, there's a greater plan here, or there's something else that's going on, and I want you to see how it settles in your mind and just explore it. If people understand that that is the mandate, they'll rise to that. But that's not how the industry works a lot of the time. The industry works by saying, okay, specifically, how do you think this should operate? And how can we make it clearer for you? And music becomes a really important tool in that, right? When you're making a film, very often, because you can't go back to the original performances, they've been shot, you know, the structure is there. The only way that you can calibrate people's emotional response is through music.
Right.
You know, I've had conversations about this with my composer, longtime composer, Michael Dana. You know, in the films that we make, the earlier films and the lower budget films, we have a lot more fun, because we can actually respond to what we're feeling as opposed to what a test audience is reacting to.
I'll point out, too, Michael Dana, we do a symphonic soundtracks feature every day at 5:30, and we've featured Michael numerous times. It's nice to get to the film composers and put a spotlight there. But I also feel like seeing as many of your films as I have over the years, that it's not just that initial viewing either. It's how you're digesting it in the weeks, months, sometimes years to come. Mm. I mean, I think I want to talk about the film Ererato in a little bit, but I mean, that's a film that still comes to mind, and I still am guessing how I feel about that, or wondering how I feel about those certain scenes. And you're sort of a master at that, where we can live with those films for a long time and understand them again and look to them again.
Thank you. That's a huge compliment. I humbled by it, because I'm also thankful that films are preserved. They last. When you do an opera or you do a theater piece, it's very much of the moment. And if it stays with you, it's because something in the experience imprinted itself, and there's a feeling you have that you can't shake. But it's amazing to me that, you know, I was just speaking to somebody who works here, and they were talking about a film I made with Ryan Reynolds called Captive, and how many times they've seen it and they keep having to watch it. And that's just wonderful to hear, because you realize that something can continue to grow, and that it goes back to what we were saying before. There are questions that have not been answered, but there's something about the energy that the work is able to give off that draws you to it, makes you return and try and understand it better. It's like a connoisseur who listens to different interpretations of a piece.
Sure.
And is trying to understand how one artist is able to refract and give you that piece back in a way that is unusual and which wasn't what you were expecting. And sometimes a work can do that just because of where you are in your own life. You know, you've changed from the last time you saw it. The world has changed. We've gone through different experiences. So when you encounter that work, it has a different bearing on you.
If you're just joining us, celebrated film and opera director Adam Egoyan is here. His new digital interpretation of Bartók's Bluebeard's Castle, streaming at coc.ca as part of a season like no other. with the COC. So, Adam, you took this story, you added to it, you enhanced the backstory of these two characters, Judith and Bluebeard, intertwined it with one of your beloved films from 1999, Felicia's Journey. The piece is built for the moment, both from a distribution perspective, but also how you look to reestablish these characters in the modern context. So how did you build around this opera?
Well, it was a very unusual situation. Like a lot of people, I'm a huge fan of Robert Lepage's production of Bluebeard's Castle. It's been remounted several times, and it was going to be remounted this past year. The orchestra had been booked, the singers had been booked,
right.
But because of COVID, they couldn't present it physically. So I was offered this opportunity where if I could do something with a minimal set, and I could do it where it could go live or virtual, depending on where things were, then I could experiment. I just take for granted that people know that the Lepage production is there. It's not going to go away. I take it for granted that people can look at any interpretation of Bluebeard's Castle on YouTube. There's several very excellent ones, which are very true to the text. And I thought, well, isn't there a way that we can actually address some of the ideas in this, which are problematic? I mean, in our culture now, right. You know, he is this actually an exemplar of toxic masculinity, right? He's invited this woman into his castle and basically says, you know, you're going to be the next victim.
Right.
And she just, you know, falls for him, you know, like she's under his spell. So there's
a lot of that in the bulk of opera, let's suggest.
Right.
Too,
so I just thought, why not tell another story, which is about a couple that have some sort of relationship to each other, have a relationship to the piece, and are engaged in some sort of a game where they're playing out the piece, and you're not quite sure where the lines are in terms of how they've inhabited these characters. And the keys to the seven doors become like USB keys, right?
Right.
They're keys to...
Now, these doors traditionally in the opera would be to some sort of munitions or some sort, yeah. But we're going different directions.
Well, we are and we're not. We're basically, I also remembered that when I was writing Felicia's Journey, the film with Bob Hoskins set in Birmingham, I was thinking of Bluebeard because he has actually kept video recordings of his victims in this secret room, which he locks with a key in the film. And we've shown that. You know, so it's quite explicitly linked to Bluebeard. The film is about his latest conquest, this young woman called Felicia, played by Elaine Cassidy. So there was something there to be explored, and I'm just dying to... Unfortunately, I can't watch it live with people, and that's the best way of understanding what's working and not working.
Right.
So it's a little frustrating when you're showing it virtually. I hope that one day we will be able to present it, because it's designed to be something that you can mount for what would be a concert performance. So, you know, where you have the singers and the orchestra and you don't have a full set, this set is simple enough that you could actually present it in that way.
And then have those visuals over top of your film.
Yeah. So when you watch it, you'll see that screen. You'll kind of understand that it's actually very much all downstage. It's, you know, using that very small stage area. Imagine that the orchestra could be behind it, playing it. So it's something between a concert reading and a stage reading, though. By the time you watch it with the digital broadcast, it looks like a stage. It doesn't feel like a concert performance. And we use the blackness of the stage to really represent the blackness of the castle as well. We're really making it a recording of a theatrical event. But it is a hybrid, because you are also inhabiting the film. And he somehow has collected many of the props that you see in the film.
Right.
So that's a really important element. Like, why does he have these props? And I have an explanation of that, which... I shared with my singers, and it's very coherent. I'm kind of hesitant to give it, but I'll say it anyway, which is that he must have a relationship with the actress played by Arsenia Khanjian in the film, who is a cooking show host, that our Bluebeard must be related to her. Without being specific as to how and why, it was a troubled relationship.
So there's that connection to the film there, and so you've integrated it that
right.
way. Right.
Now, but he's, even though we see the boy in the film, I would say that he's probably the son of the actress, and that's why the actress might have kept those props, and that's why he's using them now with Judith, played by Christina Szabo, quite wonderfully. So there's a lot of play. There's a lot of room for interpretation. I think some of it works way beyond what I would have thought. Like, I love the way it ends. It's like, it's kind of amazing because without giving it away, it's a wildly different ending from the opera. But I think the music strangely supports it. The music is incredible, right?
So beautiful
it's
Béla Bartók.
So, but here's the other thing that a lot of people don't know about the opera. It was written by Béla Balázs. Béla Balázs is one of the foremost film theoreticians in Hungary. There's a film studio named after him.
Right.
So it has this link to film through Béla Balázs, who wrote the libretto. So there's a clarity and there's a cinematic quality that's inherent in the libretto. It's sleeker and more efficient than a lot of libretti.
Right.
It allows for that sort of play. But the music, you know, look, you're responding first and foremost to the music because it's really exceptional. And the COC has done, again, this incredible job. I mean, under Johannes Debus's, you know, direction, there's a conversation before the piece between Johannes and I, and I think it kind of gives you can feel his excitement in playing this music.
That's right. And it runs about 8 to 10 minutes of you two setting it up. And it's a wonderful introduction to this. And of course, you can watch it at coc.ca. You know, there is this movie within a movie feel to this piece at times. And that does remind me of your great film, which I mentioned moments ago, a film I oddly think about all the time, and that is Ararat. And it had a great impact on me seeing it. It made me, certainly brought me up to speed on a lot of history. I've asked myself questions about why you decided to go that route to tell that story. And
I think in a lot of the other art forms, references made to the process itself, like so many great novels are about someone writing that book, right? And it's something we take for granted when we read literature. And a lot of music, composers use quotations in a certain way and they frame motifs in a certain way. So with Ararat, it was like I was aware that the history existed at one level, but that it's also a vulnerable history. And that the idea of asserting it through a classical sort of historic representation didn't serve to express how fragile history can be and how there's something troubling about the fact that our sense of history rests in the efficiency of a work of art to express it, that there are histories that are communicated between individuals. And I would suggest that the greatest sort of history that's explored in that film, it's what happens between the Christopher Plummer character, who's a customs agent, and this young man that he happens to stop that night, who we gather was working on this epic film at some level.
And right.
So it unfolds in a very unusual way. But I wanted to find, in that film, how to talk about four different generations. The generation that was directly affected by the history, the generation of the children of the people who were affected, the grandchildren, and we even go as far as the great-grandchildren. So there's four generations. So the story ostensibly takes place in Toronto now, but it stretches back into an event that happened 100 years ago, and we see how it's refracted in these different lives and how certain... It's a whole other topic, but...
It is. I mean, I guess it's layers of storytelling, and it's, the ability to work with these two different available ways of telling the story. You could go strictly historical, as you pointed out, or you can use this other level to find the more sensitive parts of that, and I love it. I've been thinking about it forever.
It as long as it has an emotional root. You know, it has to be rooted in something that's emotional. Like, I think that there's an intellectual gamesmanship in this, and in this design, there's a way that you are structuring things which is more intellectual, but at the end, especially when you're dealing with opera, it's an emotional form.
Hearing
the human voice express itself at that level is something that is quite overwhelming to people, and you have to respect that first and foremost. So I do feel that what we arrive at the end of this interpretation of Bluebeard's Castle is quite radical, but it feels emotionally true. And I don't want to give that away, but it's wildly different from how the story that is usually presented ends. Let's just say that Judith does not go into that eighth door.
You'll have to watch. Is there an opera you'd like to direct that you haven't had a chance to be a part of yet?
Yeah, I mean, there are tons. I have an opportunity, it hasn't been announced yet, but to do a Benjamin Britten piece.
And
I've always really loved the idea of working in English, right? So that I can actually have direct access to the to the language, right?
That would be right there with it, be present with it.
Yeah, that's always quite exciting.
It is.
You know, and I haven't had that really.
I mentioned this earlier. I was so thrilled to have your sister on the program last year. They made this great documentary about her creative process. I really felt like we were led into her creative process, and she's got a concert coming up.
Yeah, April 8th at Kerner Hall, and it's actually the first time she's presenting music that she's composed herself, so it's a big event for her.
Eva Goyen.
Yeah.
All right, she'll be there. Kerner Hall, beautiful Kerner Hall. It's like, as one friend told me one time, it's like sitting inside a violin.
Well, I just saw an opera there for the first time the other night, and it was just so amazing. It was Handel Rinaldo, but what a beautiful production!
Yeah,
it's so well set up. It's what a jewel box we have.
Yeah, absolutely. Adam McGoyan, such a thrill. Thank you so much for being with us this afternoon. We really appreciate it. Bartók's Bluebeard's Castle, directed by Adam McGoyan. It's now streaming as part of the COC's A Season Like No Other. You can stream it at coc.ca. My name is Mark Wigmore. That's our look at the arts.